listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Today, Josh Kuhn is joined in conversation with two well-known Los Angeles chefs, Cynthia Hawkins and Ricardo Diaz. Joachim Splichal from Patina Group was unable to be with us today. He's not well, but he is also represented in this book. He made a great contribution, too. Cynthia Hawkins is the owner of Hawkins House of Burgers in Watts, where her commitment to serving only the best, fresh ingredients for decades, has led her restaurant to be celebrated as one of the best burger joints in the United States. Hawkins is the youngest in a family of successful entrepreneurs, and she grew up helping her parents manage their 50s-style malt shop, later converted to Slater Market, a neighborhood grocery store, before taking over the space and reinventing it as Hawkins House of Burgers. Ricardo Diaz is the chef and founder of Colonia Restaurant Group. He grew up in the restaurant business, and at the age of 9, he was already washing dishes every weekend at his family's Mexican seafood chain, El Siete Mares. And out of his passion for Latin cuisine, he founded Cook's Tortas, Guisados, Bizarre Capital, Colonia Taco Lounge, Colonia Publica, and in 2014, he became executive chef of Santa Monica's Tacoteca. Josh Kuhn's first collaboration with the library, and I'm sure many of you here were able to celebrate with us for that occasion, was Songs in the Key of Los Angeles, an examination of early sheet music of the city that also resulted in an award-winning book, as well as new recordings, public concerts, and an online web series. Josh is the author of Audiotopia, Music, Race, and America, co-author of And You Shall Know Us by the Trail of Our Vinyl, among many other volumes. And when you walked in today, on your seat, those were not reserved signs, those were blank menus, and we hope that you'll describe your ideal LA meal, and we will collect those in the lobby, and they will become part of the collection in the exhibit. Afterwards, Josh and our guests will be signing the book in the lobby. Please take some time over the next months to fully enjoy that marvelous exhibition upstairs. The neon lights are beckoning you inside. And now please join me in welcoming Josh Kuhn.
Hi, everybody. How are we doing? Good? Kind of emotional to be up here after this project, coming to the end of our beginning, I guess it is. Really, really thrilled to have you all here. I also just want to join the chorus of thanks before I bring my guests out. I want to thank John Szabo, city librarian, without whom, without his sign-off on this and his support, we would not be able to do projects like this. Ken Brecker of the Library Foundation, who's here somewhere. I want to give a big round of applause for Ken. For having the vision and the patience and the real vision to support this and make it happen and let us kind of go wild with things in the book and in the exhibit. And there's been an incredible team of people involved with the book. Angel City Press, Scott and Patty are here, I think. There they are. Without you guys, obviously, the book would not be possible. Whenever I do books with Angel City Press, everyone says, oh, your books are so beautiful. And I'm like, yeah, but I didn't do that part. That's Amy Inouye, who designed this book and the last book, and she's the one who makes it look so great. Char Houston is maybe still here in the house. Maybe Char left. She was one of the designers for the exhibit, so I want to publicly thank her. Big, big team. So I just want to offer a few brief comments about what this project is all about, what the book's about, how it ties into the exhibit before I bring my wonderful guests out today. As you've heard, this is a project based on the voluminous and massive 9,000. I've been told getting closer to 10,000 menus in the library's menu collection. The vast majority of that menu collection is readily available online, searchable. There are JPEGs of cover inserts and back covers that anybody can search and find your favorite restaurant. So when you get to that moment in the book when you're like, how is this menu not in the book? Go to the website. It's on the website. It's on the website. There will be many of those moments. There's only 200 menus in the book, only about 50 or 60 or so in the exhibit, and the online archive is extraordinary. Started in the 1980s by librarians. It's a collection that has been maintained. I want to stress this, been maintained and preserved and curated to a certain degree by librarians. Without them, that collection would not exist. These projects would not exist. Where I come in and the work that we've been trying to do with this book and with the exhibit is to, on the one hand, honor the historical importance of an archive, of a collection of that size and that magnitude, and then take the next step to say, okay, now what do we do with that archive? How do we animate it? How do we bring it to life in such a way that it's accessible to the public, that among the 9,000 plus stories that are buried in all of those menus, how do we choose some stories out of all of those in order to kind of create a community of dialogue and discourse about what these menus represent? So how do you animate an archive? That's really one of my kind of key obsessions with these projects. And we animate it through the book, through the exhibit, through public programs like this, through an event we're going to have in August. And so it's about bringing it to life. One of the ways I wanted to bring it to life in the context of the book is I invited 8 contemporary chefs to do what we called remixing menus. So if you have the book, or inevitably when you get the book, you will, for all of your friends and family, Hanukkah starts now. You can go through, in the back of the book, there are 8 chefs who took vintage menus. I asked them to choose menus, and they each picked one, and they rewrote it. If they were going to cook that menu in their kitchen right now, what would they change? How would they reimagine that menu? People like Nancy Silverton, Susan Feniger, Michael Wexler, Jazz Sing-Sinong, lots of other folks were involved in that. A key figure in this book in helping us remix and reanimate and ask the right questions is Roy Choi, who wrote the foreword to the book. Feel free to clap for Roy. I'm always down for a Roy applause. Was very supportive of us, came in and looked through the menu collection with me very early on in this process. Worked with my students at Three Worlds Cafe, one of his ventures, trying to get us to think about food history and food politics, that one on Central Avenue, and met with my students, who I want to shout out, USC undergraduates and graduate students, particularly Perry Johnson, who I know is here, a graduate student at USC Annenberg, who has just been indispensable as a project manager on this. Roy really helped kind of shed some key critical light on things, and he'll be in the mix on some things coming up. So, quick note, yes, we talk about these as menus in their most basic sense. They are listings or presentations of available dishes and their prices that tell you what to order, the instrumental value of what a menu is. But in the book, I try to talk about menus as urban texts. How do these menus function as kind of windows into greater social and cultural issues? Issues around race, class, and gender, demographic changes and shifts, neighborhood politics, things we're going to talk about up here on this stage in a second. When faced with the enormity of this story and the enormity of the collection, I thought it made sense to begin by, in a way, starting with a personal entry point. And so the book begins with an autobiographical relationship to these menus that I thought, just to start us off, I would read a little bit to you right now. It starts like this. My grandfather fled the Nazi takeover of Hungary for a life in LA restaurants. His first local job in 1951 was waiting tables at the Brown Derby on Wilshire. He served cracked Alaska king crab, chicken a la king, and Cobb salad for $2 each, crab meat Louis for 25 cents more, and for the high rollers willing to part with $2.85, the all-white meat creamed turkey derby, topped with cranberry jelly. He left the derby for another Wilshire mainstay, Ollie Hammond's Steakhouse, where he took orders from red leather booths for both the world's finest small steak and the world's thickest small steak. That thickness was worth about 75 cents. all alongside Chateaubriand for two and a steak and eggs that was being modest. It was really filet mignon, eggs, hot cakes, bacon, and coffee. My grandfather's old world accent was still fresh in those days, and he fit right in at Little Gypsy, a Hungarian restaurant up on Sunset. He kept his black bow tie straight, his white shirt pressed, and his white jacket as spotless as one can when balancing plates of Magyar fazirozot, kolosvari, stuffed cabbage, and Segadiner paprika chicken. If you didn't want to trip back to the old country, he also served assimilation on a plate. Hamburger steaks, New York cuts, top sirloin, and other welcome to America dishes cordoned off from the goulash and schnitzel on the menu's left page. Now, the Little Gypsy wasn't the only Hungarian place in town, and soon my grandfather's waiter wages were enough to earn him part ownership of the Budapest Hungarian restaurant on Fairfax, where my father, who's here today, dispatched meal tickets after his junior year classes at Hamilton High. If you've ever listened to music in the old Largo, then you sat amongst the Budapest bones. Its menu was pure national fantasy, with an aerial shot of the Danube and the Hungarian parliament on its cover and a shot of an elegant outdoor restaurant in Budapest on the back. It did far more than describe what you could order. It was time travel, an exile's return ticket home with Hungarian wine, chicken paprikash, and knackerel as an in-flight meal. Though you were probably wise to avoid its roast goose, which was once described by Paul Wallach as tasting like, quote, it had been cooking since last Yom Kippur. After selling his share of the Budapest, my grandfather went back to waiting tables at the steakhouse at the downtown Hilton, where he worked for over two decades. The only possession of his that I still have is a gift that was given to him by the Hilton when he left to take yet another job waiting tables at the Ramada. They spelled his name the old Hungarian way, Nicholas, with a Z, and thanked him for 23 years of service on the back of a gold-plated pocket watch. And so once I started approaching the collection from, in a way, that standpoint, the standpoint of the restaurant service industry, as much as from the standpoint of a diner, as much as from the standpoint of an owner, the question of history started to rear its head. How do we tell this big story about LA restaurants? And it was hard to do since there's never been a book written on the long history of LA restaurants. This was a big surprise, kind of a shocking one, terrifying one to me and my students when we realized we had to actually start to do the primary research about establishing the timeline of restaurant culture in Los Angeles. So one of the things I really like that I'll just share a little brief part that then brings our guest chefs today out on stage is an early timeline of LA restaurants, the first of its kind that I know of. And it goes something like this, pre-1900s LA restaurants. 1849, the French restaurant of the Bella Union Hotel opens. Technically the first place to eat a meal in a restaurant setting in Los Angeles, but not technically a restaurant because it was room and board in the hotel, but 1849. Then in 1850, we get what I believe to be the first restaurants in Los Angeles. Both the Old American Restaurant and the Franklin Restaurant open. Early 1850s, Nelson's Opera Restaurant. 1852, John LaRue opens LaRue's Restaurant. As Harris Newmark put it at the time, the food made up in portions what it lacked in quality. This is also when food critics were born. Let's see, early 1860s, the first Chinese restaurant opens in Los Angeles. 1870, the three-story luxury hotel Pico House opens on Main Street with a French menu. You can see the Bella Union and get a sense of early LA there. 1874, the Star Restaurant opens, as do a string of boarding house eateries like Brown's, Sulin's, John McDonald's, and Otto Evers. In 1875, we get the first menu in the library's collection. This is from Don Mateo Keller's annual vintage feast and ball at his winery on Alameda Street. A winery on Alameda. It's gonna happen now again, you know that. Lots more dates, including 1876, Victor Dole opens his first French restaurant, The Commercial, on Spring near Temple. 1886, Charles Hama Shigeta opens the city's first Japanese restaurant on East First Street. And 1888, Frank Blackburn opens what was perhaps the city's first black-owned, so-called at the time, race restaurant, a coffee and chop house at First and Los Angeles streets. And that timeline, of course, develops in great detail over the years. So I want to pick a couple more dates to bring our guests out and to honor our guest who is not here today. So we go up to 1939. when James Hawkins leaves Arkansas for Los Angeles as part of the so-called Second Great Migration, this one from the U.S. South to the West. Hawkins opens a malt shop, which becomes a food stand, which becomes a grocery store, which then becomes Hawkins House of Burgers. And ever since the 1950s, Hawkins House of Burgers has been serving some of the most delicious and the biggest, as we'll talk about, the biggest burgers that you can ever imagine. It is now run and owned and operated, and it's a kind of performance stage for this incredible guest of mine. Please welcome Cynthia Hawkins.
Thank you for having me. Truly honored to be here.
And then in 1968, the grandparents of Ricardo Diaz opened a spot called Guadalajara Carnitas on Brooklyn Avenue. See, I've already forgotten all my images here. This is early Watts. There we go, Hawkins House of Burgers. More Hawkins House of Burgers. We'll come back to all these, Cynthia. And that was on Brooklyn Avenue in 1968. 1972, they then opened a Mexican restaurant on Whittier Boulevard. And in 1976, they opened up the first of many El Siete Mares stands and restaurants. I'm guessing people have eaten at. And now their grandson, the great Ricardo Diaz, who's going to be joining us. Give it up for Ricardo. There he is. Who, as you've heard, is responsible for so many great restaurants, Guisalos, Cook's Tortas, Bizarra, Capital, Tacoteca, and the list goes on. We'll talk about I told Ricardo at the beginning, he opens a restaurant every week. It's good. There's Siete Mares. I'm just like bad PowerPoint boy today. There's some of your stuff, Ricardo. And lastly, in absentia, in 1981, Joaquim Splichal arrives in Los Angeles, where he becomes the executive chef of the Regency Club in Westwood, and then moves on to open the 7th Street Bistro downtown, Max Triang in 1984 in Beverly Hills, and then moves up to open in 1989, Patina in Hollywood, which then becomes, over time, Patina at the Walt Disney Concert Hall, and then the Patina Catering Group that pretty much you can't go to the Hollywood Bowl without eating something that Joaquim has been a part of. He also holds the honor of having the restaurant, sit-down restaurant, that is the closest to the library and Cafe Pino just outside. So he, of course, sadly cannot be with us today. So we're gonna focus on, we'll reference some of the stuff that I think his career in terms of fine dining and gourmet dining kind of touches on. But I wanted to start with you guys. I'm so happy you're here.
No, thank you.
So really honored to be here.
It's good.
I am.
I told Cynthia I wanted my coat with my name, but she didn't.
I thought I was coming here to cook burgers for everybody. That's why I came dressed appropriately.
It can happen. I want to make sure I didn't leave all my notes. We have all my good questions. So the first thing I wanted to talk to you guys about was the question. I started with the story of my grandfather, in part because both of you come. These are family stories. And that it's really hard to talk about food, obviously. It's hard to talk about eating without talking about the culture of our families and family memories. And each of you come from long lines of folks who have been involved in the food industry and cooking. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about those backgrounds, kind of what you grew up thinking about food, what role food played in your lives, and we can go from there. So I don't know, Ricardo, do you want to start?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for the invitation.
Of course.
It's wonderful to be here, and it's a wonderful book, and, good job. I wanted to congratulate you and the staff and everybody that was involved.
Thank you.
growing up in the business, it was almost like a love-hate. I mean, you love to eat food, and you love experimenting and discovering new things, but it was also my weekend drudgery, And this all summer's long, so it was always work. It was always washing dishes and working. There was a very strong work ethic in my family, mm-hmm. And so if you were either studying or working. So it wasn't just my history with food, or it's not just around the table. where we discover, you know, what things we like and what our family's like. And it's, like I said, it was kind of also dictated by the effort and mm-hmm. the work and the kind of the industrialness of mm-hmm. of sweating it out.
And where did you grow up? What neighborhood did you grow up in?
I was born in, in Highland Park. Mm-hmm. So I lived there about 5 years, and then we moved to Montebello. So basically, up until college, I was kind of on the east side of Los Angeles.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. What did you grow up eating?
Everything. My mom, she didn't have many recipes. She had like four good ones. So she's not here, right? You know, you're not recording this, are you?
Yeah.
No?
Okay. Podcasting right into her.
Yeah. And so she doesn't have a computer. It's okay. And you know, some of those recipes actually—it's actually like the sandwich, the tongue sandwich, mm-hmm. beef tongue, which is what was my inspiration for Cook's Tortas. I mean, I just built that restaurant so that I could present the, you know, the cow's tongue sandwich to the public. And so, you know, she had that. She was from Northern Mexico, so there was that kind of style of cooking: chimichangas, a lot of flour tortillas. But what really dictated the food in my family was my father, who loved chile con carne. So basically, you know, any type of meat, you know, charbroiled or seared, and then my mom would make like a salsa, you know, kind of, and then just cook that in. And that with beans is what we ate almost every day because it was his favorite. And so, what was the question? Start talking about recipes and I get lost.
You're in. But it's clear that the way you grew up eating and you know, the cooking of your family has influenced the way you cook now.
Right, right. Yeah, basic principle, just outstanding dishes, something that was creative in our home individually. And I've tried to do that with my menus, you know, and just actually make the food that I love to eat. Whether it's fully authentic or from some part of Mexico or not, or it's just kind of a I don't know, something, you know, Mexican bachelors do because that's what's in the fridge. You know, we put it together and all of a sudden it's a dish.
Now you're going to have to break that down. What do Mexican bachelors do?
No, I mean, for example, at Colonia Taco Lounge, I have what we call a campeón taco, which means champion in Spanish. So because, you know, you'd maybe open up the fridge and there's really nothing to eat. Maybe some bacon and a little can of jalapenos, a piece of cheese, and you kind of put it together. And then your friends would come along and, oh, I see you're eating the breakfast of champions. So, you know, that's what inspires that taco there. So it's almost like I said, bachelor food.
Yeah.
You know,
Cynthia, you grew up where?
In West California. My parents came here. Well, my father came here initially, him and his dad. He told me riding on a mule from Goole, Arkansas. Find a better place for his family. It's 14 of us. I'm one of 14. I'm the last of 14. And they came here. My father found the corner right there on Slater Street and Imperial. And he settled there. He sent for my seven sisters first. Then my parents had six boys after that. And then 9 years later, here I come. So my father found that corner over there, and we settled there, and it's been history. My grandfather built the building, 19, you know, he built it right there. And we had the malt shop first. My sisters ran the malt shop. Like, it was something like Happy Days, where the girls, you know, they were dancing and having those things like that. And then later on, my father had a funeral motor escort service. He was the first black-owned funeral escort service in the city of Los Angeles. And my brothers, you know, they rode the motorcycles and, you know, for all the different funeral homes. And then later on, he went to do the grocery store. So we did the grocery store. And then I was in college, USC, and there was a need for just food. My father used to give out turkeys and hams every Thanksgiving, every Christmas, every holiday for the needy, because there is a lot of needy people in the area, homeless, elderly, handicapped, all different type of people. And my father just made it a point that every holiday he would just feed the thousands. He wasn't a rich man, but he just felt there was a need to take care of the community. And that's where, you know, he embedded that into his kids. And that's where I said, Dad, that's, you know, I want to have a restaurant here to take care of the community. So, you know, even though it doesn't make any sense financially to, you know, just feed people. If somebody come into my restaurant and they're hungry, I know that. I mean, you know, you can tell the difference between somebody who's just running a game on you and someone who's really serious. And they come here, I just can't turn them down. You know, my daughter say, "Mommy, you can't do this." I say, "No, just leave it. Let me handle this. Let me do it my way." And that's the way I do. I mean, I just cannot see a person hungry. I just can't do it. You know, so I love what I do. It's my passion. My brother used to tell me, "Cynthia, get out the kitchen. Let somebody else run it." But that's my passion. I love being in there. I make love to my burgers. I don't know what's wrong with me. So I like to be there.
I have to say, when we started working on this project and I went to first meet Cynthia and try to interview her, I couldn't interview her without the grill window, the takeout window in between us.
Through the window.
Like always working. So we're thankful you're not working today.
Oh, yeah.
Just to be with us.
I'm truly honored to be here with you, Josh.
What'd you grow up eating?
And I was working earlier before I came.
I know you were. What'd you grow up eating?
Oh, my mother, you know, there was never a day where, you know, it's amazing that my mother cooked every single day for us, you know, whatever it was. They had a thing called hoe cakes. I don't know if anybody know about that. It's like, I guess it's a pancake, a sweet cake. And kids would, all over the neighborhood would come over there and eat it. That's what my sisters would tell me, older, you know, back in the day. My parents did the same for us. But there was always kids at the house because my mother would always cook. And whoever wanted to come over there and eat, they can come over there to eat. So that's just the way it was. It was, you know, neck bones, chitlins. That's our, you know, that's fried chicken, of course. You know, we have to have our fried chicken. Everybody loves fried chicken. That's like something everybody likes. But, you know, just collard greens, black-eyed peas. You know, that's what mother, she just cooked a home-cooked meal every day. Breakfast, it was always breakfast. Like my mother, every day my mother cooked.
How did you guys prepare the chitlins?
Oh, we cooked them. You boil them. You know, you got to put potatoes in there because they do stink. You clean it real good. You boil them, and they're delicious. Put those peppers in there.
Oh, okay.
Oh God, they're so good. Ooh.
But we'll boil the chitlins, and then we'll fry them up or put them in the oven to get them nice and crispy.
Exactly. Oh God, it's nothing better than ooh.
No. Yeah.
It may sound gross, but it's delicious. Believe me.
So since this project starts with the menu and goes in lots of different directions, could you just talk a little bit about the way as chefs, as owners, you guys think about the menu itself as an object and how you kind of think about designing it or where you place it? We were talking a little bit backstage before about kind of the decline of the heavily illustrated, heavily designed menu, the rise of, you know, kind of return of menu boards, things like that.
Yeah, we were talking about earlier that just like, let's say, from the 70s in these last 3.5 decades, I saw the menu go from just kind of like listing, as you see in many of these, just kind of printed, leading dots, all the way to the price. In the early 80s, you started getting like these kind of marketing companies and designers and graphics arts people. And they're coming out with these rules, like, you know, don't lead to the price, you know, because you make people pay attention to that. They start doing, you know, marketing, psychological reports on how people read menus or, you know, which page they look at first and which area. So the menus really started being changed with pictures, with, you know, accent boxes and stuff that you wanted to push and produce. And I think then the 90s come and just graphic design just, you know, drops in terms of pricing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's still in the early 80s, you still had to go, you know, get plates pressed and, you know, big machines using ink. But by the 90s, it was so inexpensive that, you know, everybody went to, like, I think, you know, pictures, mm-hmm. a lot of colors, you know, high design. There was people, you know, kind of hawking those services, you know, to every restaurant available. And I think in this new... the start of this new millennium, especially with the expansion and the blowing up of cuisine in Los Angeles and all the ethnic varieties, all the types of restaurants, a lot of the chef centricity, celebrity chefs, we almost, you know, there was a pressure to create daily, to do specials, to show off, to do something different, to be regional or seasonal. And so I think the menus have just moved back to kind of printed copy. Mm-hmm. You know, where it's maybe done a daily menu or a weekly menu. And so everybody's just kind of doing that in-house now. And all those menu printing companies, you know, they're Probably struggling a bit.
We have one that I talk about in the book that's in the exhibit, the Lord Printing Company, which was the only printing company in the country that only printed menus. It was based here in downtown on Beaudry. And they lasted, they pretty much ran the entire 20th century. And then it was indeed in the late 80s that they closed shop for many of those same reasons. But most of your restaurants, not all of them, but you use a lot of menus on the board, on boards or on chalkboards or on the walls, right?
Yeah, that's just, you know, form following function.
Right.
You know, makes it easier to switch things up and it's highly visible.
Cynthia, what about you? How do you guys think about
it? You know,
you've got it right there. So yeah, you know exactly.
I'm really extensive. Yes, it is. You know it is, but. And I'm trying to condense it a little bit, but, you know, pictures, a picture is worth 1,000 words. You know, people come into your restaurant and they see a picture. Oh, my God. Because we don't have the fake pictures. What you see is what you get. So they come in and say, oh, my God, I got to have one of those. And another thing is the internet, word of mouth. Because our restaurant, we're in Watts. We're a hole in the wall. We're across the street from the Nickerson Gardens, where all the gangsters are. But they respect us. We have no plexiglass in the front. It's like a family-oriented business. You come in here, it's your family. You know, this, like I tell my customers, this is your business. You know, don't act crazy. This is your business. You know, you guys should be happy. We have people from all over the world come to my, they come to my restaurant and watch. Get off the plane, come right to Hawkins. I consider my place Hawkins House of Burgers United Nations because people from all races come to my restaurant. And that's amazing. They sit out there and enjoy themselves. They go to the Watts Towers, they come to Hawkins because it's one thing I do. It's expensive to do it, but I sell only top quality food. You come to Watts, you're going to get the best. And that's a guarantee. That's a guarantee. And I mean, I just love what I do. I'm trying to condense it down some, but I'm working on that.
One of the things that we found in doing the research for the book is the kind of the early history, I guess you could call that, you could think of it as kind of, you know, of like ethnic entrepreneurship, of early turn of the 20th century restaurateurs, many of whom who started as street vendors, who then turned into kind of early mini food empires, kind of early versions of celebrity chefs or, right, you know, or franchise chefs. Al Levy, for example, was a Jewish restaurant owner who began as selling oysters in his oyster cart, parlayed that into a series of Al Levy's restaurants that he then put the oyster cart on the top of the restaurant. Three stories. And also the incredible, that you can see a little image there of the Casa Verdugo that was run by Piedad Yorba, that opened in 1905 in the Glendale foothills, and as Charles Perry, a great food writer for the LA Times, who has been a big part of this project, he talked about her as the first true celebrity chef in Los Angeles in 1905, certainly the first Mexican celebrity chef and Mexican woman to kind of rise in the ranks of that business. And I'm just wondering, for each of you, how do you think about kind of the role of a restaurant in either this kind of vague category of, you know, ethnic identity or community? I mean, what's been the role for you guys in your own histories with your grandparents, of seeing how important or maybe not so important a restaurant, of owning a restaurant is toward building a community?
You know what? When it comes to food, you know, food is important. You know, everybody, kids, everybody like food. I just think that just having a restaurant where people can just eat that good food, you know, they think about that good mouth-watering food you go to bed thinking about, you wake up thinking. Restaurants are important. I mean, you know, you people go out now, a lot now, more often than they do cook when they, you know, back in the days, but my mother used to cook for us every day. People don't do that anymore. Right. So restaurants are really important. And I don't think it's like a cultural thing, because if it's good food draws everyone. Yep. You know, it's not just, you know, it's good for the neighborhood, it's good for the community. But if you have good food, people will come from everywhere to get it. You know, and that's what I think.
And leading on that point, I think the impetus for doing a restaurant, it's not so much about the food. I mean, because that's, I think it's that entrepreneurial spirit. It's, mm-hmm, and especially with immigration, yeah, here. You know, people are coming here to build a better life, to work, and they want to own their own business.
Yes.
And I think the restaurant model is one of the easiest because, you know, you're doing that at home. It's not like I got to learn to be a tailor, mm-hmm, or I have to learn how to, right, I don't know, make bricks or any skill. It's something that's already there. And it's, well, you know, your wife cooks wonderfully, or your aunt does, or your, yeah, mother. So you normally, they're the ones that start building the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Use their recipes, and then it grows from there. But I think it's more just seeking to do your own business. And then, you know, the the more savvy or the more marketing inclined, well, then maybe, you know, search a location and certain type of menu or, and but, you know, we all start cooking what we want to eat, what we're missing.
True. That's absolutely true.
And if you look even at, if you go down to Hawkins, for example, it's not just, you're being a little modest here, it's not just Hawkins House of Burgers, it's like across the street, it's four different Hawkins businesses.
Yes.
Right? The 99, Hawkins 99 Cent.
Yes. It's entrepreneur. That's my parents. I mean,
they own the blocks. They own those two corners, yes. right there. And it's all Hawkins. And I think it's a really, it's a testament to this, what we found in the collection, this long history of that. Of that immigrant spirit, of that kind of community spirit, of the importance not just of being a cook, not just working in a restaurant, but owning it, right? And be able to pass that down, you know, grow the family through it, et cetera. The other thing we saw a lot over were kind of literal representations of restaurant menus and how they relate to maps of the city. Mm-hmm. So a lot of restaurants were putting maps of L.A. This is the Bullock's, downtown Bullock's Tea Room from 1937. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you can see. And it's just interesting to see how different restaurants saw the city. And you've talked a little bit about this already, Cynthia. So maybe we'll start with Ricardo on if you could talk about neighborhoods and where you've chosen to open your restaurants. And why those choices have been made?
Well, personally, I'm a San Gabriel Valley boy. I mean, that was my stomping ground. You know, in Montebello, I went to school in Rosemead. I did a year in Fullerton before they asked me to leave. I finished at Whittier College in Whittier. But you know, I've always loved the Valley, and it's down-to-earth people, you know, just middle class, just working. Apart from trying to introduce an expanded Mexican menu mm-hmm. or Latino menu from what we've been eating here for, you know, 40, 50 years, which is kind of like a Tex-Mex influence, mm-hmm. I also wanted to, you know, bring higher quality, more food with more attention to detail in Mexican to that valley. I mean, you know, there was a lot of great food on the west side. I mean, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you know, you had to go to Robertson, you had to go to Fairfax, even Pasadena toward the later part of the decade. And there was nothing in San Gabriel. We all knew of little small holes in walls. But that's kind of been my goal, to just bring better quality Mexican to the San Gabriel Valley.
And you're doing a lot in Whittier. Specifically,
right? And Whittier, because I live there, been working on the town. It's kind of, you know, turned into a little foodie town. So there's kind of a wave happening. So I'm just kind of trying to ride that.
Okay.
You know, take advantage.
Cynthia, when you you know, you've talked already about the importance of Watts to the restaurant, to you personally, to your family, your specific location, you know, between the freeway and Nickerson Gardens. You've seen a lot over the years.
Oh, of course.
And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about, like, you know, what, maybe we could start with the relationship between the housing project and the restaurant. And there, you know, there's a shootout story you told, you know, that I know it involves a restaurant.
Yes. Well, what happened with that, my father was a kind of person that he did not like to see any type of illegal stuff going on in the area. If anything went down, he was right on top of it. Well, you know, they used to snatch purses. Like Imperial Highway was like the main route to the airport. There was not a 105 freeway at the time. So, you know, that was the main route. So everybody would come that way, and the kids would come from across the street, stop the traffic, and snatch the purses. My father wouldn't do that. You know, he wouldn't stand for that. So they would rob people. It went completely out of control. So there was one incident where they were robbing a lady and her kids, and my father was attempting to stop, and my brother intervened, and one of the gangbangers got killed. And you cannot have a business right by the gangbangers and think you're going to be in business after one of the gangbangers get killed. But like my father said, you know, it was amazing. The guy got killed and that night. But first of all, we've been there since 1939, so my parents were just like, they were there over there. My parents were right there in the corner. So we know people like they do. So they were going to come over and blow us up and burn the building down and do all that. So my father had friends in the projects. Mr. Hawkins, they come over to burn you down. It's 14 of us. My parents have 14 kids, 100 grandkids. So my father said, the only way I'll leave here is in a pine box. Nobody's going to run me away from my my property. Nobody's going to do that. So there was an actual shootout. It's called Shootout on Imperial Highway. I mean, it was an actual shootout. There was like, you know, police could be police forever and never be involved in a shootout. And there was an actual shootout. So finally, the amazing thing about it, you know, there was a shootout. Guys went to jail for years and years. But they wrote us letters because they knew my father was a good guy. You know, he stood for right. And he wasn't going to tolerate that. They went to jail and they're my favorite. They're my best customers now because they knew they were wrong. I'm serious. They are. We went to court. I testified against them. My brothers did. We had the shootout. My father would have the shootout at night, wake up in the morning, open up his store. I'm sitting there. That's the way it was. I mean, you can look it up. It's called Shootout on Imperial Highway. He said, the only way I'll leave my property is on a pine box. Nobody would let me, would force me out of my property unless, like in a pine box, and that's what he did. And we're still there with no plexiglass, with the same people that shot at us and all that. We're still standing.
And in 92, during the uprisings, mm-hmm. You guys were feeding people.
Yes.
No one else was feeding in that neighborhood.
No one else. The uprising is amazing. I mean, it's not something I'm happy to say, but when they had the riots and all of that, everything burned down except for Hawkins. You know, it's sad. I mean, they burned down the whole area, which is sad to say, but we're still standing. Since 1939, we're still standing. So it's amazing.
You know, obviously, when people talk about the history of Los Angeles, and especially the history of restaurants, I mean, one of the key developments in L.A. urban history, the rise of the automobile and the car becoming so central to the identity of Los Angeles. And 1930s and 40s got all these drive-ins opening up. Wilshire Boulevard kind of crops up as a drive-in centerpiece. And I'm just wondering, for each of you, and when you're thinking about your restaurant, your customers, opening new ones, how much of the kind of driving culture or the automobile heart and soul of Los Angeles actually figures into the way you guys think about what you do, or does it at all?
I actually don't. I think, you know, the most businesses are supported, they're based on the locality and the community and the people going there daily.
Yes.
So, for example, I'll open up a restaurant in Whittier, and, you know, you get some press and people, you know, Chef Ricardo Diaz opened up a new Mexican place. So I'll get people coming in from the west side, but they're not going to keep coming back. You know, maybe they'll come back in 5-6 months, but it's not a constant. So it's who lives there, and that's your basic bread and butter daily. Those are the people you have to serve and take care of, and those are the people why I maybe change menus up or provide variety for, so that they can keep tasting something new, while, you know, keeping stuff that if you get rid of it on the menu, they get angry.
Right.
Yes,
you know, even though, we want to change things on the menu, but it's like, don't touch that.
And yes. Get rid of the molded fries.
Yeah, we're always like, she said that she's trying to condense the menu, make it a little bit smaller, but they're just, you know, stuff that, you can't get rid of.
But, you know, it's amazing. It's the stuff that you have this big, huge menu, but people come here for the same thing over and over. Let me have chicken and waffles. Let me have a Whopper burger. Let me have a bacon cheeseburger. It's like, you know, you have the big menu, but they always want certain things all the time on that menu. That's amazing.
How many Whopper burgers do people eat a day?
Oh,
let's be honest.
Oh, God, it's amazing. You know,
Hold on. What's on a Whopper burger?
All of our burgers are huge, even the junior burgers. They're good. But it comes with two Angus beef, Angus patties, black Angus patties. Let me say that, black Angus patties. I haven't gotten to the Kobe yet or the Wagyu meat yet. I haven't gotten that. But it has pastrami, hot link. Oh, it's so good. Oh, my God. You see, I have my uniform on. I'm coming up to cook for you guys today. Ah, man. But it's really delicious. You know, it's amazing because Andrew Zimmerman for Bizarre Foods came out. You know, it's supposed to be a Bizarre Foods. So he said, what's so bizarre about a Whopper burger? But I guess he was doing things in the L.A. area, you know, women serving the community, whatever. So they chose me. They chose me to be a part of that. I'm happy I did. But that Whopper burger, oh, my God. It just blew up after that. It's amazing. Woo! But it's really delicious. All my food is good. Try it. You won't regret it. It's delicious.
When we started this project, I mentioned at the beginning that Roy Choi came in with me to look at some of the menus. And the first thing I did is pull out all of the earliest, kind of the rarest early menus from the late 1800s, early 1900s in the library's collection. They all tend to be, especially from the late 1800s, banquet menus, very elegant, kind of elite banquet menus, private affairs. And I said, look at these, isn't this great? And he looked somewhat unimpressed and was kind of like, that's great, but where did everybody else eat? And this kind of planted the seed for thinking about this project, about really paying close attention to the way that restaurant menus, for the most part, it's a privileged archive. It's a privileged history of where, you know, it's a record of where people who have enough money to eat out can eat out. And so we tried really hard in the book and in the exhibit to kind of pair. I mean, we've got here, this is a luncheon luncheon menu from 1905 from Tate's, which is one of the many kind of working class, affordable lunchrooms in downtown Los Angeles. And then a kind of classic fine dining, a California Revolution, California cuisine menu, Ma Maison. This one's from the 80s with an original David Hockney painting on the cover. Two, you know, kind of poles, I think, of what Los Angeles is known for. And I'm just wondering for you guys, I mean, you especially, your restaurants vary in price in some ways. I'm just thinking, how do you think about the question of affordability of food, this issue of fine dining, of lunchrooms, of the kind of class consciousness of food culture, if you will?
Well, I mean, when you're writing a menu, you know, once you've decided what kind of food you're cooking, or if, you know, as chefs, well, we have our strengths or our styles. I try to price with a comfortable profit margin. And I do know that a lot of it is dictated by area. Mm-hmm. You know, if I do the same restaurant in Beverly Hills or in hipster Silver Lake or, if something versus Whittier, for example, there's some price discrimination that goes on. Mm-hmm. Just because it's a different class. It's also your overhead, of course. You know, I can pay, you know, $3,000 for a space on the east side, and it's going to cost me at least $7,000. All that labor, overhead, rent, all that, it's a lot more expensive. So you do have to account for that in your pricing. I like to be comfortable, just kind of a straight margin. But as Cynthia also does, you know, we buy high quality, you know, that we get the better skirt steak or the better chicken, whatever we can find. It pushes my Mexican prices up a bit. But, you know, people will appreciate, you know, the care and the time we take and put into those dishes. Because most of the stuff that you might eat on the street, while wonderful, and a lot of it's delicious, depending on who's making the salsas or... But, you know, they're always seeking to bring down their cost and, you know, use lower price meat because, you know, they're going to sell, you know, 30, 40 tacos and they might make 50 cents on it. Right. If they can make 60 cents, you know, that gives them an extra $20 or mm-hmm. That they can help to go to their rent or whatever it costs them to. I think one thing that's wonderful in Los Angeles, I think a lot of people don't make their restaurant choices by price. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, well, we only have to go there because that's the expensive place.
Right.
Or, you know, we're just stuck in this culture and we can only eat, you know, from small stands and this area. I think that's a wonderful thing that it's really opened up where you can, you know, approach a lot of different restaurants. You know, very expensive, maybe some of the most expensive restaurants in Los Angeles aren't requiring dress codes like they used to. You know, I mean, it's California. You can go into shorts and a t-shirt into Animal or any of those, you know, great restaurants that are, you know.
Yeah, and Ma Maison was actually a real big pioneer in that of, you know, very kind of elegant fine dining and that you would eat in plastic chairs on AstroTurf. You know, the kind of California casual, idea. Cynthia, you told me before that you guys also adjust your prices in a way depending on customers.
Yes, we do. I have like a thing for the Nickerson Gardens. Where if you live in the Nickerson Gardens, whatever I serve, whatever price it is, you automatically get 25% off. That's my way of doing that.
That's cool.
And, you know, I have the Yelp discount. You know, you have that. But my price, I have a burger. You can get a burger, fry, and a drink at my place, a junior burger, for like $2.59. Where can you get that from? So everybody can, you know, it's like it goes. My burgers go from $1 to $25, $30. It depends on the kind of burger you want. If you want to add all the extra stuff on there, of course it's going to be more. But I just make my price is affordable to everyone. Whoever comes there, they can afford something. And you will be full. Like I said, my burgers are not the kind of burgers you'll find at McDonald's.
That's the trick.
My burgers are filling. From the junior burger to the Hawkins special. which is a burger that I don't know why people even order. That is just ridiculously big. But they order it all the time. But is my price affordable to anyone that comes in the door? Is affordable to them.
So, like, this is a 1937 menu from the Globe coffee shop from downtown Los Angeles that, if you can make out on the right side of the screen, focuses on all the different sandwich deals and all the different kind of sandwich sizes. Like in the middle there, it's the hamburger sandwich for 15 cents, hamburger sandwich with toasted bun, tomato, and pickle. So a 15-cent burger, a 15-cent sandwich. And all the three-deck sandwiches. And since both of you work with hamburgers, do a lot of work with tacos, can you talk a little bit about, you know, why you think L.A., among the things L.A. is known for cuisine-wise, trends come and go, but at the end of the day, we're a sandwich city, a burger city, and a taco town.
Yeah.
We are.
Ricardo's like, yep, yeah,
we are. Kind of. But, you know, well, at the end of the day also, I mean, just Asian too, you know, that influence is very strong from our Chinatown to, more importantly, like Monterey Park and that part of the valley. You know, I don't know many other cities where you can find Burmese, Vietnamese, you know, now Sichuan and spicy Sichuan and all the, not just Cantonese anymore. I think that's a big part of our variety and our calling as a food capital.
Yes. And we see that in the menus. It's interesting. You can see that really kind of pre-1960s Chinese menus, for the most part, were just billed as Chinese food. And it's after the 1960s that you start seeing it become much, you know, much more regionalized, Mandarin, Sichuan.
And any chef now that like starts on something that's fusion, it's basically mixed with the Asian influence. That's that's the fusion, you know. Whether it's Roy Choi, you know, doing the tacos, and it's easy for us to access those flavors and those spices. Our markets, our local markets, apart from being a bountiful growing area and a lot of space, and people can grow their own stuff and come to these farmers markets and present vegetables that we knew nothing about 15, 20 years ago. We're also the home of McDonald's, right? So, and In-N-Out.
I
like their hot mustard sauce. Yeah.
You like the hot mustard sauce?
Yeah, don't mess with the hot mustard sauce. All right. And In-N-Out. Yep. Whether it's the drive-in that led to that, and the cars and the theaters. The hamburger.
Hamburgers. It's like a hamburgers, hot dogs, tacos. That was like, it's amazing, isn't it? You never get enough of it.
and there are also foods that I think translate all around the world.
Exactly.
Like pizza does. Mm-hmm. It's no matter where you go in the city, you know, you can do a hamburger, you can do a taco, you can do a pizza, and it just, right away people accept it. Exactly. They get it. I don't know if it's, all children love it. It's the food that they love most, pizza and hamburgers. I don't know, there must be something basic in our genetic makeup that draws us toward out of those three food items. I don't know
but that's right.
You know,
when we were these are some of the other. I wanted to put up the Spago menu, the Trump's menu, to represent that other history that Joaquim, of course, is a big part of. One of the things, getting back to some of the drive-in stuff and some of that mid-century, these are restaurants some folks might recognize or know, iconic restaurants in the history of Los Angeles. That when we started doing research revealed some interesting stories that I wanted to share with you guys and get your reaction. So these are, two restaurants that have been written about a lot. The Witch Stand is a drive-in known for its architecture in particular. Turns out that in 1952, the Witch Stand was the site of one of the very first sit-ins in Los Angeles, where an African-American teenager was refused service, and he came back with his friends, and he launched one of the first major sit-ins in Los Angeles at the Witch Stand. The Nicodel is a great story that the great Buddy Collette, great musician Buddy Collette, told about working on the Paramount lot just off Melrose, where everyone during the day from Paramount would go eat at the Witch Stand, and he went there. African-American went in with his then white girlfriend, and the manager of the restaurant didn't like that, and sat them somewhere so everyone could look at them and kind of, jeer at them. And he said the only good thing about the Nicodel's menus being so large was that he could cover space with it. And so there's this kind of long history that restaurants help us to think about of segregation in the city, which tends to often get buried, I think, in our nostalgia for the 1940s, for the 1950s, especially in terms of restaurants. And I'm just wondering, in each of your own experiences, I don't know if there have been anything, but is there you know, maybe hearing from your grandparents about how they thought about restaurants and how they thought about the city in terms of these color lines being either overtly talked about or kind of invisible in some ways.
Well, with Siete Mares, and when they did the first kind of seafood, it was a Mexican restaurant beforehand. One of the reasons that I've heard from my uncle and my grandfather for starting it was seafood at that point was only available like in San Pedro and on the dock and kind of these dark restaurants, you know, and red lights and very expensive because it was seafood and maybe, you know, Italian influenced. So their culture, the Latinos in this area, really didn't have access to seafood. And that was one of the reasons why, you know, they started Siete Mares, was just to give them access to that. Plus, of course, I mean, the rich coastal history of food in Mexico makes it easy. But I think that was one of the goals. So, you know, it was for our community.
Okay.
You know.
Cynthia, do you know, did your father, I mentioned in my opening remarks that you know, some of the first black-owned restaurants in Los Angeles, up and down Central and San Pedro and First, you know, date back to the late 1800s. How much of that sensibility of kind of the racial division of the city figured into the way your dad thought about the restaurant?
You know, my dad was always like, he was colorblind, colorblinded, nothing to him. You know, he just, everybody, I'm not bragging, but everybody loved my father. He just had that gravity. So he really never looked at it that way. It's just, you know, everybody was drawn to my dad, and I just think that the restaurant business is just something that everybody loves and people love to eat. And I don't think color, I don't know if it's good or bad to say that, but it's true. He just never said anything to us about the prejudice that confronted him or whatever in regards to restaurant. He never did that. Maybe it's because my mother cooked all the time at home. And they never went out to eat that much. Mm. With 14 kids, how can you?
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah. But, you know, we're driven by that entrepreneurial spirit. I think we want to feed everybody. It's not, you know, and we want to share our food with everybody,
exactly.
You know? It's like, try this. It's so delicious,
right,
you know?
Right.
Discover.
Right.
You know, sometimes, like I said, sometimes you have, you know, decision-making of which culture you're going to, you know, attack or market to, but we want to feed everybody.
So let me show you some of these. I wanted to get your reaction, Ricardo, to some of the kind of visual, visual representations of Mexico.
That doesn't look like me.
No, yeah, I do. This is the belly. Yeah,
your
working
people.
On it.
Yeah.
This is the evolution of the L.A. sleeping Mexican. Like 3 of 20 that we could show. But I mean, you know, so much of the visual culture about how, and even, you know, in the case of El Cholo and the Red Onion, you know, Mexican owned, of using caricatures that were recognizable to non-Latinos as a way to say that this is a place that you can feel safe at in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did you ever go to the Red Onion?
No, I've been to Cholo.
I have.
Yeah. I used to go to the Red Onion.
Yeah. Yeah, good food.
But interesting, in the 1950s, advertising themselves, in Inglewood, advertising themselves as Sonoran, right? Not Mexican, but
not
Sonoran
Mexican.
In that way. Mm. Cynthia, and this is from a Thrifty's menu from the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
Thrifty's Spanish Kitchen. With the sarape and the sombrero. The sleeping Mexican was asleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the other room.
You didn't make the menu.
Yeah, you got to make the menu. But like, how do you think about, or did your parents and grandparents think about that tradition of kind of Spanish cooking, like Spanish rice? You know, it's a Spanish tamale, not a Mexican tamal. In terms of how kind of Mexican food is talked about?
I don't think my family, you know, cared too much about that. I don't. You know, it's approachable iconography, you know, it's something, whatever culture we think about that we're not highly, highly exposed to, there's only going to be a few items that we can, you know, relate to. I don't know, whether it's, you know, blue and white plates from Denmark or, you know, the colorful sarapes from Mexico. Spanish, I mean, and, you know, in Mexico, we do raros español. I mean, you know, we say it too, you know, and Spanish, you know, either, I mean, technically Spanish is either going to be the country, Spain, or the language. So, you know, it's easy to kind of just overlap all that, all those descriptors.
You guys are being gentle on history, man.
Yeah, you know, like I said, you know, we want to work and we want to.
Oh, come on.
You know, it's that.
All right, I'm going to keep pushing buttons.
Are you going to keep pushing buttons?
All right, Cynthia, go.
Oh, looks like Angie Mama to me there. You know, when I look at that, it makes me look at, you know, people like Southern food. And they see that, you know, because back south, the black people ate all, you know, they did all the cooking, took care of the kids. So the food was, I mean, I guess the food was really good. So when they see a black lady with the, looking like that, they say, oh, the food got to be good. This is Southern fried. Right. This is Southern food.
It's home
it has
cooking.
To be good, right. You know, so.
And these are both, white-owned restaurants with an all-white staff.
Right.
Right. You know, that and this is Carl's, one of many Carl's restaurants that kept changing the menu up. This one's a kind of plantation, you know, menu on the cover.
Yeah, but Carl's kind of checking to see if he's going to let you in or not.
That's right.
Yeah, he's looking at you.
If only that were Carl.
Where you live.
If only that were Carl. You know.
Oh, my gosh. And what is this?
This is Maxie's Singapore Spa on Fairfax in the 1930s. Wow. One of many menus in the collection in the exhibit that I think both Chinese-owned and non-Chinese-owned restaurants that kind of trafficked in, you know, heavy visual character in the 1930s. But at the same time, you know, much later, by the 1950s and 60s, you get Chinese and Chinese-American entrepreneurs who are keen to put their own faces on the cover of their menus, mm-hmm. right? To say, this is my restaurant. Kind of controlling the food, controlling the business, but also controlling the image in some way. I'm going to skip that because we're going to be out of time. But I want to have us talk about the remixes you guys did for the book. Ricardo, I asked you to look at this. This is from 1930s. I'm guessing Mademoiselle Poitier's restaurant on Olympic Boulevard in East LA. And you remember growing up thinking about French restaurants, not this one.
No, yeah, growing up, when we moved to Montebello, there was one French restaurant that I knew, Chateau Marcel's, I think
Marcel,
it was.
Marcel and Jean's.
And Jean's.
Yeah.
Never got to go there. It closed and then burned down before, like I stayed in a book, before I could make my own dining decisions.
Right.
But I always wanted to. I mean, it was a beautiful chateau, and I'm thinking French food, you know, what is it? So I never got that opportunity, but seeing this menu, it was what struck me. That there was another restaurant in East Los Angeles. And I know it wasn't always Latino-based.
Right.
You know, I talk about, I mean, Montebello, there was like a big Italian and Armenian populace there, as well as Glendale. You have different areas where pockets of cultures, you know, the Jewish culture along Brooklyn Avenue and Boyle Heights. But I never knew of any, like, French areas. So,
on the east side. Yeah. I mean, downtown it was heavy in the early, you know, late 1800s. You know, like a lot of French vintners
along the Alameda corridor, right?
Yeah, and like Vignes Street, Vignier, stuff like that. But later on East LA, I mean, that's why this is such a. There aren't many. I mean, there were the two French restaurants were those two,
right?
In that period. And when Ricardo looked at the menu, and this is in the book, so I'm not sharing secrets. But Ricardo went through and made notes. We reproduced it in the book, made notes on the menu. And I don't know if you remember any of these offhand, but if you could share a couple of your reactions to it, I thought they were really interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the biggest thing that I noticed was just maybe the exoticness of, uh-huh. of the dish. Is that the correct word, exoticness?
Uh-huh.
At the Library Foundation.
Was there, where we invent new words.
You know, I can't see them from here, but, you know, some of the... Oh, here, thank you. Appreciate that. You know, like breaded pig's feet, you know, or tripe, you know, we're talking about chitlins.
Yes.
That's you know, the... I don't know which tripe. I'm sure it might be like the stomach when we make menudo, or it might be tripe from the chitlins, the milk guts from the cow.
Yeah.
But, you know, the beef tongue, you know, like that... I thought maybe besides these small, like, ethnic outposts or holes in walls, that these larger restaurants were just kind of standard fare through, like, you know, early, you know, the early part of the century. And then it's only recently that we've started to explore and do things, you know, with other parts of the animals that were normally reserved for the lower classes. Mm-hmm. But that was impressive, and I was happy to see that. And then I also noted, like, you know, stuffed bell pepper, you know, things that that were very similar to what we do in Latin or Mexican cuisine.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the dishes you could just translate into Spanish, mm-hmm. and they'd still kind of work.
Yeah, just put chile in it, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, and serve it with tortillas, and then, that, you know, now, you got somebody's cooking.
When you put seafood on Friday with an exclamation point.
Oh, okay. Well, I grew up in that. So I grew up in El Siete Mares, which was seafood. And so all year we just waited in anticipation for Lent, because that's when, you know, we got over the winter blues, and meaning low sales. Mm-hmm. And then just Lent would recoup everything, and the Fridays would come in, and, you know, the whole family would be happy. Leading into the summer, so, you know, I grew up just very conscious about Lent, and that people looking for non-meat items would come to our restaurants, and, you know, and still, you still, no matter where you go, most soup menus, it's still clam chowder on Fridays, you know.
I also like Ricardo's sense of humor creeps in when you see a child service. What was it, 20? I can't remember.
Oh yeah, I saw child service, 40 cents, and I'm like, you know, do they charge extra for kids, or if they don't eat? Yeah, because, you know, that's what we do in Mexico. We just, you know, she orders. There's no child's menus. You just, whatever the mom orders, it gets scraped off for his plate. You know, so I don't know if they were, you know, charging for that, or if it was just meant some I don't know, smaller portions of any of the meals. But yeah, we got jambalaya and chicken creole too on that menu.
Jambalaya
on a French menu. So, there you go, in East LA. Smithswood Barbecue, Cynthia. This is the one that you reacted to.
You know, I was just thinking about when he said Fridays. That's what I'm not. You know, I just remember every Friday, my mother cooked fish. Every Friday we had fish. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? And you just like,
yeah.
Now, Smithswood Barbecue.
Fish,
I want to say, if you
read
the fine print.
You know, I need my glasses. I can't see good.
It says under special dishes, you can get abalone steak, frog legs, French fried, fried lobster tails, Cuban, barbecue hen pheasant, and then this consists of soup, salad, choice of potatoes, or barbecued beans. And then later on in the menu, it talks about how among the barbecued things that you could get would be venison and bear at barbecue. This is in the 1950s.
1950s.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is on Manchester, just east of the 110. But what's interesting, Cynthia, is your reaction was less to the dishes and more to the way the menu was designed, which I thought was really interesting. Like, you really keyed in on, like, you can't present food this way.
No, you can't. Like I was saying earlier, people usually look at, like, the picture. You know, like you said, the menu is important, but the picture, they see it, and they want it. And that's the way I look at it. You know, I change it for the specials. You know, you have to have the special. You got to have that dessert, the peach cobbler, whatever, and the banana pudding and all of that. But I just look at it, I think it's more so of a picture because, like I said before, people come into your restaurant, they see it, they want it. They see it, they see a picture of it, not a fake picture, but a real. They say, is this what I'm going to actually get when I order this? Yeah, this what you see is what you get. So I think, you know, the menu, it's okay, we have the venison and all like that, but, you know, we have neck bones. We sell neck bones here, whatever. But,
yeah. Just be clear.
Yeah, be clear about what it is. You know, show a picture, and whatever you show, produce that. So that's why that's the way I look at it, the menu.
Yeah, I mean, your reaction was very much about, you know, knowing your clientele, knowing how, they want.
Yeah, you know, you may see people that come in there for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They come in there just every day you see the same person. Like you said, the community is very important.
Yeah.
We feed the community. They come to us. They know that they come to Hawkins, you're going to get the best food. You're going to get slop. But, you know, we have people that come from everywhere else besides the community, but you have to base, you know, you say it's important to base your food in the community, but it's important
that's
to base your food in everybody.
That's what you're going to live off. That your restaurant will stay if...
Oh, of course. You have to base that on the community, but...
You know, one of the things in researching, particularly the early 1900s periods, is this kind of, and this lasted throughout most of the last century, and to some degree it still does, mm-hmm. Is this idea that LA, because of the history of immigration in Los Angeles, because of the multiple histories of immigration, early 1900s, you would read constant articles about people talking about the foreign presence, right? You can travel around the world by just eating your way down one street in downtown Los Angeles.
Yes.
But that was never seen as as being indicative of an LA character. It was always a foreign influence on LA. Whereas now, it's the opposite. It's that what used to be the kind of foreign influence is now actually understood to be part and parcel of the heart of the identity of the city. And there were all of these articles, particularly New York Times articles, even LA Times articles, saying, panicking, that LA doesn't have an identifiable cuisine. That there's nothing that we could actually point to say that LA. So I wanted to pose this very difficult question to you guys. And this was one attempt to do so, actually, but I'll let you think as I mention this. This is an 1895 Chamber of Commerce banquet menu, LA Chamber of Commerce. And every dish, and you can, if you can't see this
can
bar
see
in the book when you buy it, you can look. Every dish is named after a place in Los Angeles or a kind of LA event. The Mount Lowe Railway had its own dish. The shipyards had their own dish. A really overt attempt to kind of make it LA, right? Naming dishes after places. Michael Wexler, who's in the book, Wexler's Deli, he's been doing that naming his dishes after streets. Royal, name it after Lakers players, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And for you guys, like, what, when you think of LA, is there a cuisine, is there a kind of taste culture that you think sums up the city in some way?
Well, I thought about this question, but maybe in reference to other cities. If I think of New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and LA. And those are great immigrant cities too. I mean, New York, I mean, it was, you know, it's considered that you could eat from many cultures in the world there. So San Francisco has that too. I mean, just there's a great variety and also the Pacific influence. And so does Los Angeles. So what makes our variety different than their variety? Mm-hmm. It's automatically an East Coast, West Coast thing, I think, helps define us in terms of just our bounty of fresh vegetables and fruits. Even more so maybe Southern California than Northern California. So you have like the beginning of Spago's and Alice Waters doing, you know, their restaurants and doing this kind of new California eclectic cuisine with, you know, farm to table and fresh ingredients. But, you know, and San Francisco has that, but, you know, Southern California is so much more, mm-hmm. so much more, you know, easy access to,
yes.
Even though most of the farms are about maybe midway between
right,
both
right.
of us, right?
Yeah.
I try to think in terms of the relationship to those other food variety cities. And I just think it's a little bit tied more into our climate. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we typify fresh a lot better than maybe some of those other cities.
Okay. What about you, Cynthia?
Yeah, people, you have to, they stress that. Freshness is very important. And they look at, they want to know if is your meat frozen or is it fresh? That's really, you have to really stress that in business.
Our clients know.
They know that. And they know, you know, once you taste it, because it's amazing. If you taste quality food, you know, if you get anything other than that, you'll know the difference. You know the difference. There was a time I went to my vendor, and they didn't have my Angus chuck, and I had to get something else. And I mean, it's amazing how your customers know. You know, are you changing up on something, Cynthia? What's going on? Well, something's not right.
Right.
How, you know, they just know. You know, I said, you cannot ever run out of this. You know, I come to you. You know what I buy. Just don't do that to me. Don't run out of it, because customers know you do not want to ever change your quality. Once you start doing top quality, you don't want to go anything other than that. And that's why I'm not, I mean, don't you agree with me on that?
Yeah, it's easy to disappoint.
Yeah, it is.
So
of course, for you, you know, big shit. I'm just kidding.
As part of this project, we wanted to turn it, we're actually turning that question out to the city. upstairs in the exhibit, there are a number of these blank menu templates. where we're inviting people to actually write in and try to sum up your version of LA, your city, in a meal. They're on your seats. And we'd love for people to fill them out before you leave today, and they can be handed in on your way out, and we'll slowly rotate them into the exhibit over time. And if you don't want to do it today, take it home. You can email them in, go to the Library Foundation website. You can download the PDF of this menu. There's three different templates to choose from, including two door hanger takeout menus. Okay. But the whole point is to not write the typical, what you think might be the typical LA meal, but your LA. How would you actually, whether it be your block, your family, full of your memories, how would you sum up your Los Angeles in a meal? So in that spirit, I want to open this conversation up to everybody. If people have comments or especially questions, there's lots of stuff we haven't covered, lots of stuff, which is the theme of this project. We'll start right there. Well, I will repeat the question. The question was, what if we flip the last question that we were just talking about? We kind of flipped it around a little bit so that instead of looking for the way food defines the city as a whole, what's been the role of individual neighborhoods on redefining both the neighborhood itself, but also even the very idea of Los Angeles? And I think that's the right answer to that. I mean, among the many right answers to that question, that's certainly been the story. But it's not one that I think is universal over time. I think it's been an increasing, at least from the research for this book, an kind of increasing sense of how important the local is in LA, where, you know, you have these kind of vague terms, you know, whether it be Los Angeles or vague terms like Mexican or Chinese, that then over time become like, no, this is this neighborhood. This is how we eat here, and trying to put a neighborhood on the map versus putting a city on the map. And that, I think, is very much happening right now, where neighborhoods are really, you know, you mentioned a quote-unquote foodie scene in Whittier, right? I mean, that, you know, the neighborhood identities and city identities, community identities are perhaps even more important than a citywide identity.
Well, I mean, people are opening their restaurants in their neighborhood originally. That's where you always want your first restaurant to be. But those neighborhoods change. Those, you know, those menus, those food items, they change. Most of these restaurants that you show in your book are no longer around. You know, we know our numbers in the restaurant industry. I think it's 75% fail within 2 years, 90% fail within 3 years. By the fourth year, there's only one out of every 10 restaurants still open there, you know, that were previously open. Mm-hmm. So there's a high turnover in our restaurant scenes. And as cultures and neighborhoods change, or what's happened in Watts, you know, was largely African-American and like a lot of Latino influence moved this way. And then a lot of like, African-Americans and Black have moved out even toward like San Bernardino and Imperial County, moving, you know, and that was, you know, there was that was pretty white, you know, for a long time, those counties especially. You know, I think there's almost like little generational moves, and being restaurants such an easy business to, let's say, get started and open. Like I said, there's no training necessary for families. A lot of them are single generation, you know, because the kids want to do something else, or they educate themselves, or they, you know, want to. A few of them, myself in this case, maybe take it off in a different direction or regrow it. But I mean, all the rest of them, like for example, in my family. Just maybe one cousin out of 11 is still involved.
Right. Yeah, and like Cynthia, even at the beginning, I mean, you talk, whenever you talk about your restaurant, right, it's Watts, California.
Yeah, I mean, we brought light to a forgotten community. That's why I look at it as, you know, I just say good food attracts everyone. And, you know, you say the menu changes and stuff like that, but some things just stay the same. You like you say burgers, that's something that's like a universal thing. I don't care where you go. We were invited to go to the Middle East to make hamburgers for the royal family. I thought it was a joke at first. The idea, I mean, they kept emailing us. I said, this couldn't be true, you know. Yeah. But they sent us.
At least provide a count.
Sent for us four president. We had first class tickets, presidential suites, just to cook for the royal family. They wanted burgers. I mean, that's...
Cool.
They wanted a Whipper burger, so I made. I said, "You want your kids? They're 2 years. Fix the kid the Whipper burger. We sent you over here. We want Whipper burger." I mean, but I made. So then that was amazing. So some food is just universal.
All right.
You know, you don't change something. You don't change on your menu. I'll never change the burger. I mean, it's going to be there.
But I think to that point, Oliver, like if you go, you can do histories of neighborhoods, right? How neighborhoods change, how demographics change through mm-hmm. through studying restaurants. I mean, this, you know, you mentioned Highland Park, you know, where you grew up, and this is a neighborhood that's going under radical change, gentrification, which is, of course, a massive issue and a huge concern and a source of great debate and controversy right now, as it always has been, but really hot right now. And it's hard to find a gentrification article or discussion that doesn't begin with talking about when that restaurant opened, right? Mm-hmm. Then it started changing.
Well, a lot of those areas, I think, are defined or started, let's say, it's the artists that come first. Because it's low rent, you know, and it's cheap, and you want open studio space. And so, you know, and you don't mind being in a hood or, you know, or somewhere or next to crazy train tracks or whatever. You know, you're an artist and you're creative and crazy. You know, then come like the coffee houses to kind of feed right. those. And then the restaurants kind of come to start, you kind of feed that growing culture. And so...
Before you know it, there's an artisanal cheese shop.
And, yeah. And then you have this now gentrification, you know, but it's, I mean, a lot of it's just kind of like, you know, price seeking, you know, you're looking, you know, and then you start buying, and then the owners of properties in those areas now realize they can,
raise
their rents, right? Because, you know, and so that happens and you go and I don't know. And then, I'm trying to think of, neighborhoods that maybe have fallen. Or that have, or maybe the opposite of gentrification, because mm-hmm. you know, because everything kind of goes through cycles. I mean, we had Brooklyn Avenue, which is now Cesar Chavez Avenue. I mean, it was strong, you know, Russian and Jewish influence there,
Japanese.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. Is that gentrification when like the Latinos come in and then right. like move out? You know, the Jewish and the Russian populations. I don't know. You know, they kind of go through cycles, and I think the foods. You know, what will always reflect whatever.
What do you think happened with Old Town Pasadena? They just let it, you know, at one point, I believe back in the 80s or early 90s, it just went down to nothing. It was, all the buildings were like just ridiculous.
Just antique stores.
It was ridiculous. It was, the buildings were like boarded up. Mm-hmm. But you see it now. Mm-hmm. So what do you think happened with that?
Hopefully we'll get more good places.
Yeah, that Pasadena definitely was food driven. That just, yeah, turn that Colorado Boulevard.
And Chinatown is undergoing this. I mean, in Inglewood. I mean, these are all places, neighborhoods, cities mm-hmm. where food is being, you know, is at the center of these conversations.
Exactly.
Other questions. I don't know the order. If there were hands up back there, okay.
Well, this isn't really a question. It's a comment. When you were asking earlier, why do you think Los Angeles is a hamburger and a sandwich and uh-huh. a taco town and stuff? Well, part of it's car culture. You want portable food. Now, what's more portable than those kinds of foods? Burritos are good, too. You mm. know, things that you can eat.
Don't drive with a Whipper burger, I'm telling
well,
you.
Well, no, now that I've heard what that is, I wouldn't do that. But also, because Los Angeles is very casual overall, ever more so every day, mm-hmm. okay, then... I think people feel like sitting in a restaurant, not taking it home, and eating with your hands is like, let's do that. So foods that allow you to easily do that, I think people really enjoy that aspect of the LA, Southern California lifestyle. I mean, there's room for the sit-down restaurants and stuff too. But so that's my comment.
Sarah, did you have an order? Over there? There we go.
Would you please address the innovation of food trucks and where you think the future of that aspect of the food industry is headed?
I can address to a degree that story, and then maybe, I don't know if either of you want to weigh in on if you've ever done sure. food trucks or thought about it. But, I mean, food trucks, I would say, are part of a larger, much larger history of street vending. And mobile food, and that goes back to the founding of the city. So some of the earliest writing about food in Los Angeles were mobile vendors, tamale vendors, ice cream vendors, and push carts. I mentioned the oyster cart, people pushing carts down the street. That's always been a part of Los Angeles, and it has always been a point of controversy. So the street vendor battles that are very much alive and going on right now, push back against them, fighting for them, that's been going on since the late 1800s. the food truck story is a huge, this is a huge topic. The lonchera, history of predominantly Mexican owned food trucks serving for the most part kind of working class and construction clientele that were, had a negative reputation. You know, this had a big shift over the past 10 years where food trucks now are kind of, you have, it's like you have to have a food truck. Food trucks have their own TV shows.
Yes,
it's a ridiculous, Roy would be the person to really give you that yeah. story as well. But have you, either of you thought, have you, either of you worked with food trucks before?
In the mid 80s, I worked on one, but.
No, I've never worked on one, but you, but food trucks are real popular right now, real popular.
Would you, either of you ever open one?
I'm working on that right now.
So, well, personally, you know, when we kind of had this food truck craze coming in, you know, and the show, and
yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people would come to me and say, oh, you got to open up a food truck, you got to open up a food truck. You know, a lot of it was self-serving so that you can be in my area, you know, they yeah. would tell me. But, and I'm like, well, I already have like a couple of restaurants. You know, most food truck guys are like dreaming about, you know, owning their own right. brick and mortar. I'm like, I'm already there. So I mean, it's a wonderful way to get your food out and expose it. It's also it's kind of a hectic. It's like transporting food. It's like catering. You know, you're always
yes.
transporting food and worrying that it's going to fall over, or you know, it's, you're going to lose it or get in an accident and somebody's wedding's messed up and.
I do a lot of catering.
That's what things we stress about in the kitchen.
Right.
You know, and it's I don't know, a lot of it's economics, you know. It allows people to put their food out for, you know, a lot lower barrier of entry, mm-hmm. you know.
We have I've been told we have time for one more question.
Last question right over here.
Cynthia, this is sort of directed to you. I live in Echo Park, and there is a restaurant called Masa. It's an extremely community-oriented restaurant. It's almost like a central gathering point. Yeah. Posters in the window of lost dogs and what have you. And a monthly bulletin as to events in Echo Park. Now, since you're involved with the projects, especially Nickerson, and you know Honey and Hank and the people who work in the gymnasium and the Watts Gang Task Force, is there a way for the restaurant, especially like yours mm-hmm. and yours, to become involved in the community, go into the schools where youth are, like the gymnasium at the developments, and contribute possibilities and opening up other avenues, taking them to other restaurants to get different foods so that all of what is Los Angeles can be incorporated, even with your Wiffle Burgers?
Oh, you know what? We do, that's what I do. That's, we go to the different schools, like for the graduation ceremonies. I donate food, like for the Linwood High School, Markham Middle School, Jordan High School, all the schools, 112th Street School. They have something. Something happens at their school. I'm a part of that, and they can. They can. You know, they know they can always count on Cynthia Hawkins to take care of the community. My parents did it, and I will do it. Everybody in the community, Hank and all of them. You know Hank. That's one of my good customers. He runs the gym. He works for a housing authority. I know them all because, remember, I was born and raised in Watts, so I know them all. That's what I'm saying. We don't have any plexiglass there. They can come here. They know that Cynthia will take care of them. I do a lot. They have fundraisers. I'm always there for them. They can count on me for that. So I take my restaurant to different locations. You know, my brother and I were we were bickering over the food truck. He had the food truck, but he didn't want to do it the way I wanted it done. He had the frozen patties. I had the fresh, so we couldn't do it that way. But I do. I go out to different locations and cater. I bring the restaurant to you. All the stuff I have in my restaurant, I take it out to you. So I do that already, and I'm known for that. Well, I will do that. Bring it on.
I want to also say that all summer long at the branch libraries, 73 branch libraries across the city, there are food programs, education programs, community garden programs, diabetes workshops, obesity workshops, opportunity, hot summer lunches at select branch libraries throughout the summer for kids to come and eat hot lunches during the summer at branch libraries. This is a big part of this project. On July 14th, for the next Allowed Gathering, we're going to be tackling these very issues, talking about how to even talk about restaurants and menus in the age of extreme food injustice and lack of food access in Los Angeles. And that's our topic on July 14th. So I hope you will consider coming back and joining us. I want to thank you all for coming. Thank the Library Foundation, Aloud, Cynthia, Ricardo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.